kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to episode number 83 of Today in Digital Education, Tide, a podcast by me, Di Barnes, and...
me, Doug Belshaw. How are you doing, Di?
I'm good. It's a Friday, just after 11 o'clock, Friday the 26th of May, and I'm in the middle of the day and have a window, and we've not been able to record Tide this week, so we thought we'd do it now. It's a beautiful day here. Sun is shining. We have sports day this afternoon, then the house tennis tournament finals with which we're in, and then a house cinema trip. So I'm taking 60 boys or whatever to the cinema.
What are you going to see?
There are four films on offer, so people are going to see different things. I'm going to see something to do with Arctic, something or other, apparently. I don't know.
Is it half term for you next week?
Half term begins tomorrow, yes, after lessons. Happy days, indeed. How about you? How are you doing?
Yeah, so the reason we haven't been able to record is, like, both of our timetables, I've been in London, so I went down Wednesday afternoon and then came back last night on Thursday. So I went to the Freeformers Future of Work Summit, met up with Jim Knight, Lord Jim Knight, former schools minister, all-around good guy, and currently chief advisor at the TES. And then I met up with Makers Academy, who used to sponsor my newsletter and do kind of coding boot camps and are growing like Topsy, as the phrase goes, though I don't really know what Topsy is. And then, yeah, came back last night. So, when people, it used to be a, when I was younger, this is a bit of a random thing. When I was younger, in the kind of mining village that I grew up with, when older men, or as I was a boy, men would see each other, they'd say, "You fit?" As if, like, that was the thing that people needed to be, yeah? Like, "Are you fit?" As if, like, "Are you ready to play football?" And even men in their 50s, 60s, 70s would say this to each other, which I used to find hilarious. And these days, people would say, "Are you busy?" As if, like, being busy is a thing you need to do. Whereas I like to have my work week as sustainable and full of stuff that I find interesting and important, but not feeling stressed and massively busy. And I feel like this has been a sustainable week, which is good.
All right, I see. One that nourishes as well as works you.
Yeah, and so I get into the weekend not being exhausted and not feeling like Friday is a, you know, "Oh shit, I must get everything done" kind of day. I was just talking to my wife about this, actually. I was slightly annoyed this morning that I had, like, work to do before we're recording. And that was actually not mainly of my doing. It was because someone hadn't got back to me in time. But she was saying, "Well, yeah, but the reason you do 4 days a week is so that if you do have to do work on the fifth day, then at least you're not bleeding into the weekend, as opposed to doing 5 days a work week and then, you know, having to then do work while the kids are at home and over the weekend." And I thought that was a good point. That's the whole reason I do that kind of stuff.
Slippage. Always build slippage into everything. Yeah. That's what I say.
Yeah. And in fact, one of my clients, someone who is a consultant herself, has recently gone, she was working 6 days a week. Okay. And I said, "Well, maybe you should work five." And she's actually now working four and, with that slippage. And she's just put up her day rate and so is earning the same amount of money, but has a more sustainable lifestyle. And I think all these things are always mindsets rather than, "Oh, well, that's the reality and I just have to do that thing." I think any time when you've got some kind of control over your time and life and it's not just imposed upon you, you always have scope to change things to be more sustainable and more manageable.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me about Jim Knight. So he's taken over at TES and had quite an impact, I think. And they seem to be more dynamic, sharing their resources. The monetary aspect of it has seemed to have upped a bit. People making money out of their resources, which is not a bad thing, I don't think. Have you got any line on that?
Yeah, but the thing that he mentioned, so they're doing, I asked about their courses because the last time I was in there, potentially doing some work with them, was about 18 months ago, I think. And we were going to help them with some badges and that kind of thing. And I'm not sure if they're doing badges. I don't think they are. But they are. Their CPD thing is doing fine and they're doing courses. But the main thing is they're now the seventh top provider of initial teacher training courses.
Oh, are they really?
I did not know they were doing that.
No. I mean, he seems to have driven some sort of product diversification. It's changed tack a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So, and the reason why it's so successful is because they're doing blended learning courses and are effectively allowing people. I'd want to, before I knew whether this was a good thing or a bad thing, I'd want to know more about it. But just going off what he said that they're doing basically almost like competency-based assessment. So instead of taking people through a year's course, if they're already, for example, a high-level teaching assistant, they're measuring them on the competencies and then tailoring a course to get them to the required standard, assessing them on that, and then, you know, certifying them as a teacher in a kind of a blended way. And because they're learning a lot of the stuff online, they can do it. They're a national provider. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was quite a nice model, although, you know, a lot of teaching is just experience, I guess, but there is a theoretical basis to it. And so, yeah, I'd want to know a bit more details about it, but it's, you know, it's good that they're doing that kind of stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing he mentioned was his side hustle, which everyone has these days. And have you ever come across AngelList?
It rings a bell, actually.
I don't know. Yeah, so AngelList is a place where it matches people who are looking to, like, recruit technical people to a startup or invest in startups or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that, you know, people can invest and do all that kind of stuff. Anyway, he is kind of co-founder and investor in something called X-Rapid, which is automated malaria diagnostic kind of tests on using an iPhone.
Oh, okay, yes.
Which apparently is going extremely well and seems to be a huge deal. And, yeah, could literally change the world, so...
Okay, so it uses a portable field microscope, state-of-the-art one, with an iPhone attachment. Interesting.
Right, yeah.
Cool.
Mm. So that's that. And yeah, the Freeformers Future of Work Summit was... I learned a lot about how you get people to places on time on Thursday morning. So I, like, hustled to get to... from South London into Old Street for 8 a.m., which is the state of time that started. Mm-hmm. Got there just in time, and then they had, you know, lots of, you know, tea, coffee, snacks, all that kind of stuff, and lots of networking, but then didn't start till 9. So...
No, that is the way. People have got that quite sorted. Whenever you go to London for a thing, because people come from far and wide, and transport can always be so... it's building slippage in, as we said.
Yeah, exactly. And so... there were a few panel sessions. It was extremely well compared and MC'd or whatever by some guy from Seven Hills. I've forgotten his name, who's got an MBE and, you know, as all these people in this kind of world have. And yeah, it was extremely corporate. And I was sitting there with lots of questions about, but what about privacy? What about security? But what about, like, everyone can't be a Duracell bunny all the time. Some people aren't extroverts. The future of work isn't inevitable. All these things going through my head, but thinking, this is a different world, Doug. Like, you just need to not raise all these things in this particular forum. And John Bevan was there and thinking the same stuff, and we met afterwards as well. John Bevan being part of We Are Open, for those listening, our co-op. So, yeah, just realizing it was a slightly different world, and that sometimes you have to learn to speak the language of those kinds of people who are interested at the end of the day in the bottom line more than anything else. We'll see how that goes, but I think the main thing I got out of yesterday was the conversation with Jim, actually, because he was not only extremely given of his time, but very useful in terms of the contacts that I made as a result.
All right, well, that sounds good. So tell me, May is nearly over. Mm-hmm. Are you going to stay on Mastodon and off Twitter, or combine the two, or what?
Well, did you get the pop-up this week of Twitter's new privacy settings?
Last week I got it, I think, yes.
Last week, right. Well, I think they've been rolling it out. I got it different times on different accounts. What did you make of that?
I just went on it and... I didn't look at any guide. I just opted out of everything. I just unchecked every single box and moved on. So I didn't have any time at the time to actually pay much attention to it because I was busy with coursework. And so I just went and did that. But I will go and look at this article you put in about how to opt out of Twitter's new privacy settings.
Yeah, so this is from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The new privacy policy from Twitter, it says, it comes into effect on June the 18th. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, Twitter aren't going to go, here's the negative side of the changes that we're making. it's up to other people to point those out, as ever. So the thing which popped up in terms of the prompt on Twitter, and I'm sure lots of people listening have already had this, it comes up with tick boxes around personalized ads, personalized based on your apps, personalized across all of your devices, personalized based on the places you've been, and then in data, track where you see Twitter content across the web and share data through selected partnerships. And at the same time as they're doing that, they are removing their support for the do not track standard, which was created by Mozilla.
Yes.
Now, we could go down a whole rabbit hole in terms of the many, many mistakes and missteps that I think Mozilla have made over the last 5 years. And we'll come to that in a moment around Chrome. But one of the things that Mozilla said, and I can see where this came from, do not track was a setting that started off in browsers and then has kind of found its way into apps. And the idea is that if you as a user opt into that, then you are requesting that people do not track you across the web based on that account. Yeah. So in the same way that Facebook, like if you're logged into Facebook, or sometimes even if you're not logged into Facebook, they will track you, all the different things you do around the web. Do not track is supposed to deal with that. And the reason that Mozilla wanted people to opt in was that people were making a decision, you know, and that was the deal. But I think that has scuppered its uptake somewhat. So this particular thing, you know, if you had all of these ticked, like let's just go through it, it would mean that you would get tailored ads, i.e. they know exactly what you want because they're collecting all the data on you. Not only that, they would personalize adverts based on the apps that you've got installed on your phone. That means they know what apps you've got installed on your phone. They would sync it across all of your devices, which means that not only would they track you on one device, but they track you on all your devices and then take that together. They personalize it based on where you've been, which means they're tracking every single place you go based on your GPS location. And also they're tracking you across the web in terms of the places you go. So this is not only Twitter saying we're dropping our support for do not track. This is Twitter saying we're turning into Facebook.
Yes, I think it's I'm looking at it now, and even see if you look at what they're actually saying here, they're talking about, you know, can we use your data to do this? Can we use your data to do that? Right. And can we share it with select partnerships? And but it not you disable all of this and they can't do those things by law. But it doesn't say don't collect the data. It just says we can't use it to do these things. Do you see what I mean? So even
exactly.
though
the data's being collected, but it's not necessarily being used.
Exactly, in the way that you think it is. Because it doesn't say, well, this is what we do. These are all the things that we do with your data. But these are the ones that you can switch on and off. It's just saying the ones that you can switch on and off, which are kind of sanitized for certain parts, I imagine, of their business plan. And yeah.
And I guess most people will just tick, or just okay, whatever. Yeah. And by default, they're all ticked. Yeah.
A lot of people I speak to want personalized ads. You know,
yeah. So the last paragraph of this article on the EFF website, it says, quote, Twitter has stated that these granular settings are intended to replace Twitter's reliance on do not track. However, replacing a standard cross-platform choice with new complex options buried in the settings is not a fair trade. Although more granular privacy settings sounds like an improvement, they lose their meaning when they're set to privacy invasive selections by default. Adding new tracking options that users are opted into by default suggests that Twitter cares more about collecting data than respecting users' choice. End quote.
Yes, so that is the deal. And so that's the point, is that they refresh their privacy settings, and that means everyone, by clicking review or just get on with it, are accepting stuff in the background that possibly they haven't been informed about.
Yeah. So that's all by way of background, I guess, to to a decision I made this week to switch instances on Mastodon. So I think you've been experimenting with Mastodon a bit. The question you asked me earlier was, what am I going to do at the end of the month? So that's going to be next week. Am I going to go back onto Twitter and ditch Mastodon? Am I going to stick or twist? What am I going to do? And I think I'm going to stick, actually. And I think I'm going to start using Twitter unless I'm like in an event. So at the Freeformers event, for example, I felt like maybe I should be tweeting on that hashtag because that's where people were and that's what I should be doing. Mm-hmm. But instead, I was, you know, sending tooting on Mastodon. But I changed instances on Mastodon because of a realization. So I've written about this. There's a blog post I'll put in the show notes just called Why I Just Switched Instance on Mastodon. And what I realized, Diet, was that all of the things that we're used to signing up for are centralized services. And they have somewhat of a responsibility to their users, especially if it's like Facebook and Twitter, because they've got shareholders. So they have some kind of accountability there. But I'd effectively just chosen a Mastodon instance because it's decentralized and there's lots of different instances on lots of different servers looked after lots of different people, look after by lots of different people, which are then federated together. I'd effectively chosen an instance at random. It was one of the biggest ones. It's got lots of people on there. But I realized that there were two downsides to that. Now, the first downside was that I didn't know who was running the server. They could close it down at any time. I wasn't paying for it. It's all open source software. And people could stick stuff on there that I didn't know about, didn't particularly want, and they could be doing tracking without me knowing about it, yeah? Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, there's two timelines on Mastodon. The first one is the federated timeline, so you get literally everything, the whole firehose. But then there's a local timeline of everybody who's on your particular instance. And Mastodon.cloud is just, you know, it's a reasonably popular instance. It just had lots of random people, including stuff in Japanese and Swedish and French and all that kind of stuff. So John Bevan, who I mentioned earlier, pointed me towards social.coop. And social.coop is a cooperative running a Mastodon instance. And when you sign up for it, you don't just get to sign up for it. First of all, you apply for membership. And as part of the application process, you are asked how much you're going to contribute to it on a monthly basis. And I thought, this is the thing. This is the thing I want. I've often wanted, we've talked before, haven't we, about paying for Twitter and paying for social networking, yeah?
Mm, absolutely.
Whereas this is an option where I can actually do that. So, you know, I've got how many, 14,000 followers or whatever on Twitter, and I'm following 1,000 odd people. It's nowhere near that scale. But unless I continue to support this until I put my values first, as opposed to just convenience, then the world is not going to become a better place. So I've pledged $3 a month for my particular account. So that's, what, $36 a year, which I think is a reasonable amount for this kind of thing. That means that they're sustainable. The lights will be kept on, et cetera, et cetera. And I've met some really interesting people. And there's people like Douglas Rushkoff, and the media theorist on there, Nathan Schneider, who wrote the book around platform cooperativism. Just some really interesting people. And so I've now switched, and if you want to follow me on Mastodon, I've kind of deprecated my previous account and redirected people towards social.coop/@DAJBalshaw. So I think what I'm going to do is I'll occasionally put a few bursts of stuff onto Twitter. I'll reply to people's Twitter DMs, but effectively I'm going to use it, especially in the light of its new privacy policy, I'm going to use it as an endpoint to publish. I like to syndicate my posts and my published work too. So in the same way that I only really use LinkedIn to publish, like to point to blog posts I've written and things, I think I'm just going to do the same with Twitter, to be quite honest, because I'm kind of not completely done with it, but I want to kind of refocus my energies onto things which are more in alignment with my values.
I think it's interesting. I think, you know, it's perfectly okay to have. So if you think about the different uses that you have, I mean, these tools all look similar. So you look like you only have to have one of them, that kind of thing. You know, people usually have a main social media channel, but then that's with different types of things. So people chat on Facebook, people share stuff on Twitter, people post pictures on Instagram. You know, they have a clear focus for what it is that they're doing. And usually, so in teachers, they'll use Facebook for their own stuff, but they'll use their Twitter account for teaching stuff or whatever it might be. And I think, but the most important thing that you do on any of these services, I think, is talk to people, and it's that river that's the really important thing. So I think it's a fair thing just to use Twitter as a microblogging platform, essentially, which is where you can share some links and say, here's this, here's that, and people are, it's a big river, you know, lots of people are in there, they can read it and get some traction with that maybe, and to have to conduct your kind of day-to-day business on Mastodon in as your river of conversation, as it were, rather than blogging, micro-blogging. It's where you share your thoughts and want people's responses and that kind of thing. So I think that's quite interesting. I think I don't see it's a problem, really.
And we've talked before about filter bubbles and algorithmic news feeds and all that kind of stuff. And that's really problematic if you don't know you're in a filter bubble or have created one without being intentional. And I guess here, with it being social.coop, it's people who are interested in, you know, left-leaning politics and cooperativism and, you know, new technologies and that kind of stuff. So there is naturally going to be a bit of a filter effect. But you're going into it with your eyes fully open. I guess that's the deal. And I found myself writing I think we discussed this last week, that I found myself writing things on there that I wouldn't necessarily put on Twitter, like talking about like hair fever and things. It's not something I would really put on my Twitter feed very much. Whereas on Mastodon.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? When the conversation is meaningful, I think you share more personal stuff. It's not a professional output.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also accountable. So I don't think I've forgotten when we talked, but I don't think we've talked about the buy Twitter, the outcome of the Twitter shareholders meeting, where there was a proposal to turn or allow people to turn Twitter into a co-op or to allow the users to buy Twitter from the shareholders. And that got 4% of votes, which means that it passed the threshold of 3%, which means that they can then reintroduce it as a topic next year. But really, instead of doing that, it's good for kind of raising attention of cooperativism and all that kind of stuff. But really, there's already an option to do this kind of stuff. And it's what I'm doing, which is, you know, paying my dues every month, which not only allows me to use the service. And there are, you can apply for like a free account and you have to give a reason why, you know, you can't pay or whatever. But it then kind of gets me access to the Lumio group where I can vote on different things like features or, you know, this person's being a complete dick, so we should ban him or whatever it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Interesting. So the link you've got in there, it says, we're sorry, but something went wrong on social.coop at Dutch Belshaw.
Oh, sorry, which link's that?
Sorry, it's in your blog post. So I was just looking to see what you could access on without being signed into Mastodon, whether it was a public feed or whether it was you had to be a Mastodon person to see what you were posting. See what I mean?
Oh, I see. Right. So I've put the wrong link into there. Is that what you're saying?
No, or either that or... It's down.
It's not down because I'm using it now. I've got the tab up, but I'll double check. That's the right. Okay. That's the right link. I think that's the right thing. Maybe I've. Yeah, it does. It looks like the right link, but it says it's something went wrong. So I'll double check that. But well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's not some Silicon Valley VC funded thing. It's some guys setting up an instance doing a thing.
Yeah, no, and that's a nice thing. So it's you know, when you know what's going on, you understand the technology, which is where you're using it for self rather than distributing it out to disseminating it to other people. Then you can cope. It's fine.
let's not forget that, you know, 2008, 2009 was full of times when the Twitter fail whale made an appearance to the extent that people wondered whether Twitter was going to be a thing. So, yeah. Last thing I wanted to mention, actually, before we dive into plethora of links we've got, is Badge Wiki. So I think I've hinted for a while that we have been getting some interest and now some sponsorship funding to do some work around a knowledge base for open badges. And we've just announced that. I've actually just pressed publish on the post this morning. So participate.com, Participate used to be VIF, they acquired Participate and then they realized that was an awesome domain name and also a much better name than VIF. So they started off by doing kind of come and teach in the USA programs, and now they do CPD around being a stronger educator, school transformation, that kind of stuff. And they issue badges and they just learned so much, they said, from the Open Badges community and like gain so much as an organization that they want to give something back. And fortunately for us, the way that they're doing that is through a partnership with We Are Open. our co-op, and we're creating this knowledge base. So I've been doing badges for, well, since 2011, so last 6 years. So when somebody asks me about, are there any examples of badges being used for this, I usually have one squirreled away in my mind somewhere. But obviously, that makes me a gatekeeper and a barrier and a blocker, and people like me. So having some kind of knowledge base that I think every organization should have is a good idea. And this particular badge wiki is going to be a repository for case studies and like places to just to get started if you're interested in doing badges for schools or a particular subject or for this particular type, like structure of learning or whatever it's going to be. So we're looking for volunteers to look after different sections of it, a bit like Wikipedia have people who patrol pages, look after sections, do that kind of thing. And Laura Hilliger, who's part of the co-op, the first thing she did when she joined Greenpeace, she works at Greenpeace part-time, is she realized they didn't have an internal wiki, so she implemented one, and so we're basically remixing the specifications that she got for that, and we're using MediaWiki, which is the thing which underpins Wikipedia. So starting that work soon.
Cool. Sounds good. Good idea, I think.
Yeah. So if you're interested in that, do have a look at the blog post. Get in touch with us. There's nothing to do like straight away in the next few weeks, but certainly in the next few months, I think we're going to be needing kind of, we might have some community calls, that kind of thing.
Excellent. So get in touch to get involved.
Yes, that kind of thing. Anything else to say on what you've been up to this week, Doug?
I've just had, so I'm just winding down. So it's half term next week. Got all the coursework done and dusted away last Friday. That was pretty close to the wire. Too close for comfort, really.
So I've been just
working. It's all good. Doing meetings, one-to-one meetings with people who are using these different devices in lessons. So I did one this morning. Someone's using an iPad Pro, Apple TV on their TV, and it's kind of all new to them. They're doing their best to do it. But when they're loading Google slide decks that the children have made and they're loading them onto the screen so they can go through them, they're taking forever to load. And it's an issue trying to resolve that, whether it's the Wi-Fi, but there's a Meru Wi-Fi access point in the classroom. So it shouldn't be that. But then she's saying that other devices are good, but the Chromebooks that we provided are slow to connect. So it's just like trawling through and working out why there are settings on those devices that are disrupting progress, basically. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. So, struggling with wireless display adapters, Microsoft wireless display adapters for casting surfaces Surface Books onto whatever device, onto whatever screen, sorry, and their behavior is temperamental a little bit, and you...
Well, the casting of it.
Sorry, the casting, yeah.
Yeah.
That's been problematic, and it's, you know, everyone's having to learn different sort of channels of behavior or sequences of behavior that these devices are taking, which seems to be different according to which computing device you have. It's a little bit annoying. You have
to... Well, going back to the world of silos, it's really sad.
That's true, but not in my school. So we will have a mixed environment, but every individual is going to be within a silo of their own, if you see what I mean, or every department, and that's...
No, but you can imagine if you left, for example.
Yeah.
People want... I was reading something, I haven't put it in here, but it was talking about how when it's privacy and security versus convenience always wins. And you can imagine the person coming in after you just going, oh, well, just to stop everyone whinging and to make me look like a hero, everyone's going to be using, stick a pin in it, Microsoft, Google, Apple, whatever. Mm. So I really applaud what you're doing in terms of like that mixed economy.
Well, it's going to be really interesting. So in the next sort of 12 months or more, we're going to be talking about how we formalize a BYOD policy in the school. And so the difference being is that teachers will expect pupils to have a device rather than request, which is what they have at the moment, that the children bring their devices into class. Mm-hmm. And then because that needs, it's different, you know, boarding houses have different rules about phones and about whatever. So but everyone expects the children to have the same device as the teachers. They just think it's a logical thing to do. So it's really, really difficult to police that, to pass on my vision of what I think it should be to another's. So for example, if we've been given the green light to purchase every teacher a device. If we make those devices different, say within, you know, every department, every teacher within one department has the same but different throughout the school, people just sticks in their throat a little bit. They don't really understand why that would be important. It's very, very difficult to communicate that that buying everyone different devices would be a good idea, and because we're not working in one silo, and because that's not a priority to these people in any way. And the things that you're losing, which is cascading skills, obviously, and training of how to use the devices. If everyone's got the same one, that is amplified, and so you come up against this, and then you're going to have the thing with the pupils. So if you have a surface inking device, then everyone can use OneNote, which is unique because of its infinite canvas, and that's important when you're a teacher. That infinite canvas thing, because it means that you can, you know.
Can you not do that on iOS? Does the OneNote thing for iOS not do infinite canvas?
Yes, it will do, but then you're talking. So if OneNote becomes your core productivity tool, it doesn't make any sense to not use Microsoft's Classroom Handy
and
file management tools, SharePoint, OneDrive, whatever you want to call it, and to go with Google Classroom instead. Although there are some tools out there for mixing your productivity tools, which allow you to pull them in. So you can do it, but it's not, you know, children will be handing links into a Microsoft OneNote thing rather than it being automatically connected to your account as a teacher, and that kind of thing. So people have to would have to be quite skilled, and whereas I could manage that, you could manage that, many others could manage that. There are many others who couldn't. So
it's like a conceptual overhead, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's a bit like organizations want everything to be uniform, and because it just makes sense in everybody's mind. It's a real simple logical thing, and I worry that what I want to achieve can't be achieved until you have quite a tech savvy set of people to work with. And in the first instance, you have to assume that there are lots of people who are not tech savvy. Mm. You need to do what's right for the organization, not what's right for a sort of ideological stance. But then you will face the flip side of that, which is if you put everyone down the same device, you stick them in a silo, people don't want to get out of the silo.
Yeah, exactly. Do you feel, so I remember when I was teaching in Doncaster, the role that took me into senior management was a role that the head teacher created for me. And he said, the most important thing that you can do in this new role is to create your constituency, you know, to find your people within the staff, to convince them of your kind of vision or to come up with a vision together, and then go to the wider staff. Do you feel like you've got that constituency, or do you still feel like it's your vision and you're still trying to find the people who are willing to go with you?
No, I don't think it's not my vision particularly. That is my vision. The idea of multiple silos, of not being in one, it puts to the point. Being flexible, being dynamic, people being able to use the tools that they see as appropriate. But what you do see is that as you introduce people to one ecosystem, so you know, you use Google Classroom, I'll use Microsoft's equivalent, and then you'll be a fan of Google Classroom because you're having all your little wins, you're overcoming obstacles, you're developing a relationship with that workflow, for want of a better word, and I'm doing mine, so I'm singing the songs, and so I say to the person with an iPad Pro, we're going to switch your device for a thing, and they're like, no, you can't do that, because they're really happy, they're an iPhone user, they have a Mac at home, they're really happy with the skill set, whereas if if I flip them out of that, they're going to get uncomfortable, and it's going to be difficult.
So, well, that's interesting, isn't it, that there's an expectation now that the stuff that we use personally and the stuff that we use professionally is the same?
Oh, yes. So that's
yeah, has the same kind of interface. At that Freeformers Future of Work Summit, there was somebody there from Facebook Workplace, which is Facebook for the workplace, which is, I think, is about 6-7 months old. And I think Starbucks are using it. I think even Freeformers are using it internally as a test. But it was hilarious, Di. So this woman stood up, and she's in charge of, you know, EMEA, so that's like Europe, Middle East, and Asia, and in terms of partnerships. Mm-hmm. And someone questions her, saying, so what have you found out in terms of employers' adoptions? And so she's having a go at employers for being old-fashioned and wanting to control the groups that their employees are put in, and to like spy on them and do all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, but that's Facebook's business model. Like, that's what you do. You spy on people and collect as much data and do all that kind of stuff. And then you're having a go at like organizations that do that for their staff. Like, either it's wrong everywhere, which it is, or like, you can't, it's hypocritical not to, anyway.
No, it's a difficult, it's a sort of a minefield, and it's a bit boring, really. So as the technology is so much, is advancing, and it is so much more advanced than it was 5 years ago, like what you can do with it, still the staff want you to say, this is the ticket, this one is the one. But it's not a case of that. So Google and Microsoft, they're still in development. Google is in the lead, but Microsoft are catching up, and they've got Microsoft Teams going now, and you know, it's had mixed reports, and but it's still not got the functionality required yet. But they plan to deliver that by the end of the summer.
But as we've said many times before, this is corporate stuff being given pretty much, okay, there's the occasional app which looks a bit more focused on educators, but mostly it's like corporate stuff which is given a new skin, and education is supposed to just like adapt itself to this corporate way of working. Mm-hmm. And I think if I was in your position, I'd be looking at, this isn't me giving you advice, Di, because you know what you're doing, but like, I've always tried to think, like, what would be the things which would be the little data points or the little things I could say which might convince people. And I think in my own kind of practice, the thing which I get most annoyed about more than anything is when an organization that I have no real relationship with, because they're providing something for me, you know, for free, so I just have to, like, take whatever they're handing down to me, they decide that, oh, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to pull Google Classroom, or we're going to refocus this app, which you knew was this, is now going to be focused on that instead, or we're going to discontinue, or we've been acquired, or whatever it is. Oh. And I feel like, and this is quite a hard sell, it's more like, I'll decide when I stop using this product, thank you very much, because either it's open source and therefore I can fork it, or someone else will find a way of doing it, or I pay for it, or whatever it is. Like, I'll decide when I stop using it, because actually I'm investing myself in this workflow. And my experience of working with teachers is that the thing they hate more than anything is spending lots of time dedicated to a particular ecosystem, program, LMS, whatever it is, and then being told a year, 18 months later, oh yeah, all that work you did, and you didn't actually be given any, you know, non-contact time to transfer things across. Yeah, now you're going to have to move into a new platform, it's a whole new way of working, and la la la. Because it just feels like they don't blame people, they blame the technology. And technology writ large, is technology is an evil thing.
Mm. No, I think that's true, isn't it? And it's so people make a lot of effort, and especially early adopters, they're happy to make the effort, but they don't want to make the effort twice. Do you know what I mean? Within reason. I mean, that is one of the advantages of going with Google, is that they don't tend to turn stuff off because they're so huge. You know, they're so invested in their education product that they're not going to do it. But there is, the truth is that we don't pay for it. They could just turn it off any time. At least with Microsoft, there's a sense of licensing, because we pay for Microsoft licensing across the site. But then we're not licensing the actual classroom products, and therefore they could get rid, like they did Microsoft Classroom. You know, they go so far down the development of it, and then they just stop it because they realize they've gone the wrong direction and they've the better solution out there.
And okay, Google hasn't turned off many education related products, but they've turned off plenty of consumer facing products. You know, the list goes on. Like,
I do, but I do like to think that that's them being sensible, in that they are not turning off, they don't migrate products into the education or environment until they're confident that they're going to sustain and be around.
We hope.
It's fair. We hope. But I think that's fair to say of them. So there's only like 9 or 10 services in the core product.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, talking about Google and stuff, just getting into the main links. Interesting post I saw this morning, actually, by Andreas Gall, who I used to work with at Mozilla. He used to be CTO, Chief Technology Officer at Mozilla, And then he was in kind of in charge of Firefox OS, the ill-fated mobile operating system for, mobile operating system for kind of smartphones and tablets and things. And he is reflecting on the fact that he left, like me, Mozilla, about 2 years ago to focus on an embedded artificial intelligence startup. I don't know how that's going particularly. I think it's called Silk or something like that. But he looks at the browser market and, it's not looking good for Firefox.
No, it looks very poor, doesn't it? So they're losing out. What's the pink line? Internet Explorer, which obviously Microsoft are killing off anyway. For Edge, and Edge is not on here. It'd be interesting if it was. But essentially, you have Firefox's usage. This is going up to January 2017, so up to March, it looks like, for the quarter, is not the lowest. It's just above Internet Explorer, but it's down at sort of 8%, something like that, of the market share, with Chrome being over 60%, about 50% it is. And yeah, so you can see there, but what he's really declaring is the death knell, isn't it? The toll of the bell for...
I think what he says is that, Firefox is not going to die as such, but it's no longer a force, really. It says, so it's got desktop market share and it's got mobile market share. The top graph on this particular post is all devices. And if you scroll down and look at the kind of desktop market share, then actually Firefox is above Internet Explorer and Safari as well, which is what you'd expect. But then on mobile, Firefox is just dead in the water. Interestingly, we've talked offline before about open source software, advocating it, being pragmatic, that kind of stuff. I have to say, I haven't used Firefox since I left Mozilla.
That's interesting. I just started using it again this week. I've been using Brave, so I always run Chrome, and then I run another browser as well, usually, and just to help me manage what I'm doing. But Brave is annoying me, so I've switched back to Firefox.
Why is it annoying?
This week. It's really simple things, like when you're going to click on a tab, you have to double-click it to turn to that tab.
Right.
Very annoying. Mm-hmm. And so you hover over it and you think you're on it. So you move down to an email or something that you want to read. And then as you move your mouse away from the tab, it goes back to the tab that you were on.
Oh, that's right. So when you hover over the tab, it does like a full screen preview of that tab.
Yes. Right? No, you click it once and you have to go and click it again. So you're forever doing that thing where you're
That is configurable in the options. But yeah, people really? Often just go with the default and yeah, it is annoying.
It is very annoying. So maybe I'll just turn that off, because otherwise it's been okay so far. I quite like the fact that they're looking out for me a little bit. And that's that. So the only other thing that's wrong with Brave is that it doesn't run. So I use it for my school-based stuff, and which includes Google Apps. And it doesn't run spreadsheets. So it won't load Google Sheets, and they just break.
When you turn off fingerprinting identification stuff.
Oh, I don't know. Is that, can I do that?
Yeah, the top right, it's got a thing which allows you to turn off fingerprinting, which I found broke some websites.
Oh, okay. So
in the same way the Privacy Badger, the extension, breaks websites sometimes, so you can turn it off if you feel comfortable enough. Then you can turn off that kind of protection and fingerprinting.
Okay, I'm going to make a note of those.
Or anti-fingerprinting.
I'd like to continue using it.
So I really like the idea of Brave, and for those listening who don't know what we're talking about, this is Brendan Eich, who used to be at Mozilla as well, used to be CEO for a very short period, invented JavaScript, etc. They're trying to do something which is very privacy respecting and also allows micropayments to replace advertising. So I really like the idea of it. In practice, like Firefox on Linux, I don't know if it's like I've got a really fast, for those who've listened to this podcast many times before, they know that in January I bought like a top end spec Linux laptop, and so everything should be fast on it. But Firefox is like treacle. It feels like using a 10-year-old laptop. Brave seems to work fine for a while and then slows down a bit, and I've tried, clearing cookies and settings and stuff. Whereas Chromium, as in the open source version of Chrome, is lightning fast, I have in the settings, I've got it set up so that all of my data is encrypted before it goes to Google servers, and it's encrypted not with my Google password, but with my own password, which is separate. And I have like a million privacy extensions on there. So yeah, I'm just being pragmatic and using actually an open source bit of software, which is Chromium, and getting on with doing my work, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, they're using the tools that do the job best. And yeah, anyway, so but it is a worry, I think, about Mozilla in general. This, in you know, this sort of former CTO of Mozilla declaring this, having worked with Mozilla for 7 years.
I could talk at length about Mozilla, but
best not. Let's rock on.
Yes, let's not. Right. Good. We don't have to go through these in order, Di. So just what feels like a natural segue onto something else? There's a thing. Wait, why don't we talk about Android Go?
Okay, that makes sense. Fits. Android Go is a lightweight version of Android for crazy cheap phones.
Yes.
This is a really interesting thing. When I saw this, it's not how I perceived it. I thought, so you know how Android is used for a lot of TVs? Well, I thought this is what was going to happen. So Android Go would become a rival to Raspberry Pi, is what I thought.
No, well, instead it says Google is focused on devices with very low specs, users with limited connectivity and multilingual capabilities, and it can run on devices with less than 1 gigabyte of memory. The Play Store is going to highlight apps that can run on these cheap devices. So we just mentioned Mozilla, we talked about Firefox OS, etc. Obviously, so they did affect the market in some way, yeah, because the only way so Google and Facebook and Twitter and those kinds of people, they have to provide, by law, they have to provide shareholder value. And the way that these organizations are set up is through growth, user growth, quite often. And the only way they can get more users is by going into the developing world and people coming online for the first time, often who don't have lots of money. And Firefox OS was positioned at that particular market. Well, because Facebook and Google and stuff have just got shared loads of money, they can outcompete, outspend people like Mozilla to do something new. And this particular Android Go looks like that's what it's doing. And focus on very cheap phones and tailoring things for that.
Well, I think that's right, but I think it's I just think it's adaptable. So essentially, it will be tailored to that. But just like Android is not built for TVs necessarily, it's used for TVs plentifully. And I just think developers will take Android Go, which I'm assuming will be open source as well, and they will use it to as the operating system. For a little circuit board, a motherboard or whatever, that's very mobile and can be used very adaptively like the Raspberry Pi. So you can put it into CCTV and you can put it into, you know, and control it and have a computer where you can program it to make it do what you want.
Okay.
That's what I think is going to happen. But this is a good thing, is it not?
I think it is, because I think there's so much... It's so bloated. Like when you look at stuff, especially if you're on a really bad connection. So I was at King's Cross yesterday and I had to wait for my 7 p.m. train because I'd inadvertently bought a super off-peak ticket, which meant I couldn't go between at peak times. And obviously, there's loads of people using their data connections around King's Cross, and I only had like 2 bars of signal. And so I just couldn't do stuff. Like even sending emails was problematic. And you realize when you're in that kind of situation, for people who aren't on fiber all the time or 4G, just what the web must be like?
Yeah, it must seem quite archaic and uncooperative. Absolutely. And I think it's interesting that you can't... When I often think this, when people talk about making... Nokia have just released their old brick, very successful handset, and all of that, which I just think is such... we just won't get the traction that it's been publicized to get. And but the point being is that quite often you want to strip your phone back down to a very simple device where the battery is going to last for ages, and all of that. You know, you want to go light. You don't want all of the stuff on it. And maybe Android Go would be a way of doing that.
It'll be interesting to see how they can do that while still doing the amount of data mining they need to sell ads.
Well, exactly. So I mean, the point being, the sad thing is that it's driven by Google, and therefore they are going to want to do all that tracking and that stuff. But what they might do is that you might get a more sleek, you know, at the end of the day, it's a bit like a computer. Yeah. So we need computers to do lots of different things. However, there is a core thing of running a browser and having access to the internet, which is what most people are doing most of the time on these very powerful machines. They're doing something that doesn't require a lot of power.
Yeah.
And it's about, I mean, that's how Chromebooks are so successful. So it's about that theory going onto a handset of just running a browser and not necessarily running all of the apps in the way that apps are being developed at the moment, which is quite complicated and heavy. But keeping them light and fast, going back to the principles of HTML5, really, you know, and just having
And I think going back to discussion about the browser wars and Chrome winning and stuff, I think there was a time when if Mozilla had created the equivalent of a Chromebook, then, you know, obviously the only browser you can use in a Chromebook, unless you hack it to use Linux and stuff, is Chrome. So that's how there's, you know, massive growth there. But there was a time when the web literacy work that I was doing was potentially going to be used for Firefox OS on tablets. And as you learn more about the web and increase your web literacy as a kid, then parents allowed you to then unlock more of the tablet, more of the web and things like that. Yeah. And there was an opportunity there, and, you know, everyone took the eye off the ball and stuff. Did you see that the Raspberry Pi Foundation, mentioning them, have today, I think, announced that they are partnering with Coda Dojo?
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that. Okay.
So I think it's literally today, and Oliver Quinlan's on our Slack channel, but obviously has had to keep that under wraps, I guess. I think in terms of how it's going to work in practice, the Raspberry Pi Foundation becomes part of Coda Dojo's partners or something like that. But basically, they get to work together to help kids to learn to code and all that kind of stuff. So it's all good.
Yeah, you can see putting both in, there's lots of projects that have been done beforehand. It's cool.
They've already kind of joined forces with Code Club, so yeah, it's just a rationalization of all that kind of market, as it were.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. What should go next? I definitely want to include this bit about the EU fining Facebook about the WhatsApp deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think this is the kind of stuff we need to point to when we're talking about privacy and security and data collection, and you can't trust these media giants and technology companies and stuff.
Yeah.
So it says, the European Union antitrust regulators fined Facebook €110 million on Thursday for giving misleading information during a vetting of its deal to acquire messaging service WhatsApp in 2014. And it says the commission has found that contrary to Facebook's statements in the 2014 merger review process, the technical possibility of automatically matching Facebook and WhatsApp users' identities already existed in 2014, and that Facebook staff were aware of such a possibility, the commission said.
Wow, can you imagine the emails that have been uncovered to identify that?
Yeah.
And that's some good investigative work, you'd say, and it's really nice to see an organization such as the EU holding big corps to account. €110 million euros, whatever, is not such a big deal for Facebook, is the truth. I'm sure it will hurt a little bit, but it won't break or shake them. But still, this is the sort of thing where you want to see it going, where you want to see things going, is where governments are holding companies to account.
Well, talking about governments, did you see that Theresa May basically wants to create a new version of the internet or something?
Yeah, I didn't. I'm yet to see stuff come out of her mouth that really makes a lot of sense to me. This is an independent article, and you probably wouldn't see the same thing in the Times or the Telegraph. But what is she wanting to do exactly? It's allowing the government to control that collection of data, which is already controlled by the tech corps. I mean, is that a thing, do you think?
Well, this article talks about how the Investigatory Powers Act, it used to be the IP Bill, it's now the IP Act, the Investigatory Powers Act. So this is already horrendous legislation which really infringes on our civil liberties in terms of our internet service providers having to collect data on us. My internet service provider says it will resist doing that until it absolutely has to, which is good. But if you notice, like, obviously there was the horrendous kind of attack that happened in Manchester recently. Mm-hmm. But on the back of that, if you look at what happened straight away, it's people saying, oh, well, we know that the attacker was WhatsApping before he made the attack, but we don't know what he was doing because we can't break the encryption. The like logical thing from that being, well, surely the security services should be able to break the encryption. And I, when people say this kind of stuff, either I say it on TV, so I'm saying to someone who's not listening, or we're having a conversation and people are uninformed, I mentioned the fact that, you know, when the French club, the Bataclan, was attacked, as there's many other examples of this, the attackers didn't use encrypted channels. They used SMS, yeah, which is entirely unencrypted. And yet that wasn't intercepted because actually, you know, it's very difficult to keep tabs on everyone. So
yeah, it's hindsight stuff, isn't it? It's about saying, oh, they used this, but if only we could do this, then we could have done this, but you wouldn't have done that. So, you know, it's just rubbish. It's not true.
No, exactly. Exactly. And so, right, exactly. So I feel like it's, as ever, horrific attacks and unprecedented events and things like that are used as a way to crack down even more on to remove our civil liberties. And as Theresa May quite rightly knows, now they've talked about deploying troops to protect high-risk sites. And as I said, I was at King's Cross last night, and that was swarming with police officers. And on a loop on the announcements was like, the threat level is critical, so make sure that you're vigilant, you know, all this kind of stuff. And you're thinking, what type of dystopian like future am I living in now when this is the new normal? But if we had actually had the funding, you know, if we hadn't had cuts to police services, we wouldn't need, you know, troops with boots on the ground, because we just have police officers. So it's an interesting world that we're living in at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's like when you're wanting to educate people in schools, but you're cutting schools' budgets so that they can't educate people in schools towards different things, whether it be online safety or whatever. And, you know, it's all in the wrong places. So you basically withdraw funding and then up the sort of militant aspects of things and say, well, this is the natural consequence, when it's not actually the natural consequence. And if you invest more in a civilized society towards the things that you think are going to be good, then you can actually achieve better. So she's saying in here that it should be as unacceptable to bully online as it is in the playground. It's difficult to groom a young child on the internet as it is in the community. It's hard for children to access violent and degrading pornography online as it is in the high street. And it's difficult to commit a crime digitally as it is physically. These things, well, some of these things, some of them are stupid, but like the bullying one, it is as unacceptable to bully online as it is in the playground. That's a sort of moral judgment sort of thing. But he's not understanding what the web is. It's not understanding the.
And she also allies two things together. So there's something about unacceptability, which is a judgment, which I think we can all agree with. But then she, like, on purpose takes that into, and then we need to take steps so that something isn't possible to do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the only way you can make something not possible to do is by blocking or surveilling or clamping down. So pornography is always a test case in these kind of scenarios. We've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. Now, from what I understand, I'm not sure if it's in this article, but I did read or hear that what Theresa May wants to do, or the Conservatives want to do, is make it so that if you want to visit porn sites, you have to go and register at your local police station.
Really?
Yeah.
That's the first I've heard of that.
Yeah. So, like, I visit sites which, you know, like, you need to be an adult to access. So on my mobile phone, I've had to put in my credit card details to be able to unlock access to stuff, because it ends up being like around digital literacies and stuff. It ends up being like I'm looking at stuff to do with maybe terrorism or whatever. And because it's a overzealous filter and it's trying to protect kids, you put in your credit card details. You have to be 18 to have a credit card. Therefore, okay, I can access this, that's fine. But it's not like and now you're going to be tracked across the web. You're going to be shamed into being the type of person who walks into police stations saying, can I have my porn card, please? Like, it just, yeah. So it's using social shaming to get compliance and to infringe civil liberties.
It is possibly, and well, to apply moral things as well, really. Well, let's reduce the, you know, let's stop porn being watched by making people do that. Well, people aren't going to do it, so they won't watch porn.
Yeah, and will people stop watching porn as a result of this? No, of course not. They'll be driven like further underground. They'll be even more hardcore, etc., etc., etc.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
Like, I'm not advocating for porn. I just always find it an interesting test case for these kind of situations. Anyway.
Well, I wonder if she'll get away with it.
Well, indeed. It's interesting that Jeremy Corbyn, like, the gap has narrowed since all the stuff that came out about the social care stuff.
Mm. Yeah, yes, so there was the manifesto, a U-turn debacle, wasn't there? Mm. And then there was the Manchester bombing and the responses to that as well. And the polls are now, both polls in both occasions showed a single figure lead. And the purpose of this election is for the Conservative Party to take a significant majority into the Brexit negotiations. And it looks,
and if that doesn't happen, yeah.
Yeah, that it's going to go. That, so it looks like at the moment that the Conservative Party will win the general election, but they will do it by a smaller margin than they have at the moment. So that's a difficult thing.
So, without wanting to turn this into today in politics, let's move it back into kind of an education focus. There's an article here on how gaming in the classroom prepares children for life in surveillance state. Now, I, for someone who's a DPhil researcher in education at the University of Oxford, I don't feel like this is the best and most coherent argument for what she's trying to get at. But there's an interesting point that comes out of it, which is when you are gamifying the classroom, and I feel like she is quite conservative and is like eliding a few things here, but when you're gamifying the classroom and making it so that data is being collected on literally everything the kids are doing on and offline, etc., etc., then it does have the effect of kids getting used to that kind of surveillance. And, you know, they have to carve out ways to deal with that. So, you know, can you remember that scene in The Circle? And that's the book that's now being turned into a film. You've read that, haven't you, Di?
I believe I have, yes.
There's a scene in that where the main protagonist is like expected to be online and doing stuff and everything and surveilled and all stuff. And the only place that she can have some respite is in the toilet. But even in the toilet, she's expected not to take a certain amount of time. So it's the only place where she can almost be herself without having to put on a mask. Now, everyone needs that space, as we've talked about before. And the more and more you are data collecting, the more that you're expecting people to act in some kind of performative way, either through collecting their data, online, offline, whatever, the more they need to find a place to carve out their space, and the more they're likely to do extreme things in that space that they've carved out for themselves, like take drugs, substances, abuse themselves, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so I do think it is a good point that this Laura Pinkerton is making in this article, that gaming in the classroom doesn't necessarily prepare children for life in a surveillance state, but it does if we're talking about things like, what's that app called? Class Dojo and places like that, where it's all data-based, and you effectively feel like you're in this panopticon.
Well, I was having a conversation with someone yesterday or this morning I was talking about my friend who I went to see in Thailand in Bangkok, and he's working at Harrow Bangkok, and he has to submit data for every child every week, I think it is, and the data they give, they have to score them in different categories like collaboration, things like that. So he has to essentially grade pieces of work like an 11-year-old's piece of art. He's an art teacher, and where he would never do that before. All he wants is to encourage a sense of, or to nurture a sense of pleasure in what they're doing, but now he's having to do that. And then he said that when he put data in once about this one particular pupil, and the data was below their usual attainment, So it stuck out. He received, I think, an email or a phone call saying, you know, what's going on with his pupil? And so he had to explain himself and justify himself. And he was like, well, I'm a really busy teacher. And you know, I did that thing at the time. And but he found it difficult to justify what he had done. But that's what he had done. And so he then so then what happens is that you homogenize the data, so no one wants to get the email or the follow-up phone call or email where they're being held accountable and have to do more work to justify what it is that they're saying. So what you do is you don't give them something out of line with their standard usual attainment, so you don't give too high and you don't give too low, and that way you know you're just staying within the safe bounds. It isn't going to cause you more work to do because he's already working his nose to the grindstone. And
I've been told to do this before, Di. So this was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was working at a school in Worksop in a pretty deprived area. The school wasn't doing so well. And the head of humanities told me, this is what this pupil is, you know, this is your cohort of pupils. This is what they expect to get by the end of the year. This is the expected progress through it. So this is what I'm expecting you to put into every report at the end of each term. Yes. And I was like, well, what happens if they're not at that level? Doesn't matter, you need to show progress. And I was like, well, surely some kids like regress and go backwards sometimes. Like, that's a pretty normal thing to happen, especially if you're doing different topics and you're doing, like, one kid's really interested in the Victorians and not interested so much in, like, the Romans. It's like, doesn't matter, just and he was almost like, I suggest for the sake of your career that you do what I'm telling you to do.
Oh, wow. That's a really big statement. I'd say to that, yeah. And what's the result of that is that the idea of regulation, okay, which is what surveillance is, what gamification is in a way, is that you're putting something that's human into something that's not human. So we all want to know, we want visibility of how our pupils are doing in our lessons, right, and how their behavior is around school, and to make sure everything's okay, and looking at their own well-being and that kind of thing. And but we do that in the interests of the individual, or all the individuals, you know. Once you start putting regulation and sticking that stuff out into data, then you get into the situation where you're homogenizing everything into that visibility becomes numbers that are driven by trends and possibly poor algorithms or certainly a poor procedure of what happens to that data afterwards. And that means that you end up never seeing the individual ever. I would very much, one of the things that is wonderful about teaching in the school that I teach at is that our standardization or a standardized sort of sequence of where we have to report and give grades and whatever progress is very few and far between. It's not really, really intense and all the time. It's a very different approach. It's much more relaxed and trusting of the people who work with the children. And sometimes people can fall through the loop, you know. So I've got a tutee who got 11 A stars at GCSE, but claims he didn't do any work to achieve them. And his anecdotes are all very, you know, bravado-ish about how little work he did. But speaking to his father, I know that his father, over the Easter holiday prior to the exams, sat him down, gave him exam papers to do in all the different subjects every single day, knew the exam papers and went through them with him at the end of the day when he got home from work. You know, that's quite intense. And that's what got him his 11 A stars. But now he's in sixth form. He's finding it difficult to... He's not performing on the level with somebody who achieved that crop of grades at GCSE. So catching him when he goes on poor performance mode, which he does often, is really, really difficult, to the extent that I now have to email his teachers once a week to make sure that he's performing at the high standards that he has benchmarked for himself by his GCSE.
Yeah, otherwise it's not just him, but it used to be the case that it was up to the kids and, you know, by extension the parents, you know, to do well in exams and stuff. But now it's almost entirely the school's responsibility, which is interesting.
Yeah, and you have to say, if you do it all through data, you think you're going to have the right effect, but actually you're not, because the truth of what happens with this data is that it gets homogenized into a central thing, into everything's okay, and no alarm bells are raised, no extra work is caused through, you know, if this kid's getting a low thing, it's like, do we intervene? It's not like,
push the teacher. It's like push the kid. You know, it's going to see what's going on with that child and talk to them about why their attainment may be down or whatever it might be. Data should cause human responses and not cause that have contextual understanding of the individual's progress.
That's right. Yeah. And when it comes to data, I feel like everyone thinks that more is better, whereas actually more is just more, and usually more work.
Completely, and data is useless if you don't identify something and it causes action out of the other end of that.
Which is why I think that, you know, when people are talking about, oh, you know, we're all going to be replaced by algorithms and stuff, well, especially when it comes to dealing with other humans, no, we're not, because everything needs contextualizing, and the only way that you can do that really is by having an emotional response and understanding what it's like to be a human being. And if Absolutely. We did remove all of that, then we'd be in a difficult position.
Yeah, so you go to the fantastic story of Moneyball, and so this is the Harvard accountant graduate who had an algorithm to how to win whatever they call the Major League Super Bowl
baseball
thing, yeah, and he did that, and his algorithm worked, but they can't replicate that anywhere else because the algorithms actually will only work on one occasion within a particular context.
Because and it stopped working when everyone else copied
his understanding. They do this in basketball quite a lot, where they worked out that if they took the majority of 3-point shots, they were going to win a game. But that only works whilst when they had that idea amongst the context of the game at that time, because the other teams weren't expecting loads and loads of 3-point attempts, and therefore it won games for them. But then once the other teams realize, oh, this is going on and everyone's doing the same, everyone starts defending that and you know, so it changes over time.
Yeah, and this is the problem with narrow measures, as we've talked about before. I was talking to a teacher at the local school who's a parent of one of my daughter's friends, and he was saying how I think this is the last year that the ECDL, the European Computer Driving License, counts towards, is it Progress 8 or something important in terms of school league tables. So this school is just like let's round up everybody who might not get enough A to C grades and just let's pour them through here. Back in the day, it was OCR Nationals. Like, can we find any course which looks easier that we can just push children through so that we can, you know, this sausage factory looks like it's doing well?
Yes, yeah, so there's a big distinction here, and Elan Ezekiel, hello Elan, if you're listening, shared an article with us about ICT qualifications not getting passed. So there are no IT qualifications in the next academic year, as far as I'm aware, that count.
Oh, really? I didn't see that.
That count towards your GCSE scores. It was sent to Thai Podcast Twitter, I think, and me. So he assumed that you would get it because you run that account. And so the issue with that is, I mean, you could argue that IT has a lot of interesting skills, but most IT courses, ECDL is an example. I don't teach IT anymore. That is my subject, and I now teach computer science for reference. But but the ECDL is a training course. That's what it is. It is not an education course. No. A GCSE is different to that. And it's an important thing. You remember when we were discussing discipline and a field and the different names for what ed tech is? So a discipline, it is a training course. It is a finite set of skills or activities or whatever that you can train people to do. So you're not actually, you're not educating somebody as such. You're training them to be able to do something. Like fix a car or whatever,
that's a good point actually, because I can remember when I was timetables to the OCR Nationals, and I did at the time, you know, again 10 years ago, I didn't have the, I think it'll be different now, but I didn't have the skills really to I wouldn't have been able necessarily to pass OCR Nationals distinction myself. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't prioritize like going through it enough, because it was like one lesson a week, whatever. And I remember a high achieving girl in that particular school saying, "But sir, it's really unfair we got you as a teacher because you don't know this stuff. And how on earth am I supposed to learn things?" Well, because it was like you say, a training course, and it was like do prescribed things. She ended up getting a distinction, and yes. I didn't need the subject knowledge. Whereas you wouldn't even imagine doing that as a teacher doing a GCSE and stuff.
And well, that's the interesting thing, which is why the IT GCSE, I stopped teaching it years ago, because it was training. and and hoop jumping, and it was nothing else, very little else. And whereas computer science is a lot else, you know, it's a hard and rigorous and difficult subject, has lots of undefined outcomes, and it is not training as such. You don't get trained to program. You have to learn to how to program and to apply concepts and solve problems, and it's a whole different kettle of fish.
Yeah.
You might argue that there's stuff like that in IT. So if I give you a problem, you can use a different piece of information technology software to solve that problem. And I think there is an element to that there. But yeah. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to finish off that article that we kind of riffed off, she talks about. So this is the article about the kind of panopticon and gaming in the classroom and stuff. Let me just read this bit because I thought it was kind of funny and sad at the same time. She says, quote, "In another school, students were frequently reminded by their teacher that she could see everything they did on their one-to-one iPads through a screen capture program. Later, this teacher compared their relatively gentle teaching style with that used on some of the children's parents abroad, where students had to kneel over broken cocoa shells until they'd successfully recited their multiplication tables. I guess it's easy to see how this type of modern-day monitoring is seen as relatively harmless compared to the violence experienced by some school children elsewhere in the world." End of quote. And that's the deal. Like, it doesn't look like it's this collection of data, this treating of students as little kind of bundles of data doesn't look problematic because the way that things are measured in terms of exam results. But as soon as you take away that, it seems extremely problematic because of the actual effects that it has. You know, my son, as I said before, in year five, I he's bored. And because even now, even though SATs are a year off, he's doing a lot of exam papers. And I know it's the end of the year and therefore you have end of year tests. But it seems to be more than that. So,
yeah, I think I think it's really interesting when you don't. Well, I don't know. Do we want, to, as I say, the visibility of how pupils are progressing in your lessons needs to be careful. I've been talking to teachers recently about feedback. Actually, it's really interesting when you have my job and you're talking to lots of different teachers. You don't really know what they know. So you have to have these conversations and you just assume that they understand that feedback is so much more valuable in the middle of a piece of work than it is at the end in most cases. And so I've been talking to them about using devices to give feedback and where that feedback might have impact and that kind of thing. And that it should always come at a point where the pupil has a chance to improve their work based on the feedback that you've given. Therefore, your feedback is useful rather than to take the feedback and move it into the next unit of work, which will have a different content and context possibly.
Yeah.
And that's where it's most valuable. And then you can grade their work at the end because people want their grades and they want their numbers to know that they're doing okay or where they are and that kind of thing. So you just give a grade at the end and you don't give any comment. They just get the grade that they get because your comment serves no purpose, particularly, and or certainly in comparison. So, and so in the idea of doing tests, which we're doing at the moment, I was invigilating internal exams this morning, you have this idea of achievement being, and I think that's okay. It's okay to examine at the end of a course as a means of doing it. I don't have a problem with that. But they are doing a lot of it all at once, and I can see why Ben is a bit jaded by that.
Yeah, so that thing there, linking back to the, you know, TES doing blended learning, trying to get teachers up to speed as quickly as possible, getting the people into the classroom is great. But that's why I think, you know, it wasn't too long ago that people were talking about teaching being a master's level profession and people doing, you know, mandated action research, that kind of thing. I can remember having that conversation with Edai. Whereas now, like, it's almost the opposite way around. We're trying to reduce costs. We're trying to reduce teachers' salary, you know, as a society, as a state, and trying to get as many people in as possible, that kind of thing. And with that comes a lack of that knowledge that you're talking about, a lack of the understanding that formative assessment is much more valuable than summative assessment, that when you feel like you're marking books for no reason, it's because you're actually marking books for no reason, not because, you know what I mean? Like, that's the deal.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. That's quite interesting.
Right,
I'm going to give you, I've got 15 minutes before I have to, I've got duties elsewhere.
Fair enough. What do you want to look at? There's
on the subject of gamification, let's do the Yale Dean thing.
That's, oh, okay, right.
She was trying to gamify a system, wasn't she, basically, or game a system.
So Yelp, I don't think we use it as much in the UK as they do in the US, but it's a way, like on Google Maps or Foursquare stuff, you can rate places, you can level up. It's a gamified, geolocated kind of app, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And Yelp itself as a company is not a very nice organization, and as was in the news last year about the way they treated some people, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, this particular person, June Chu, C-H-U, is a residential college dean at Yale, the very prestigious Ivy League university, and she was placed on leave this week after screenshots of her personal Yelp reviews, in which she called some customers at local institutions white trash and low-class folks, circulated on campus. And the way that this came about was that she boasted in an email to lots of students that she had become Yelp Elite, which is a special tier of Yelp membership bestowed on highly active reviewers. They looked her up. Guess what? She'd said some not very nice things, and she's in charge of diversity in the organization. And also she has a PhD in social psychology, for goodness sake. And she'd said stuff bad enough. People talked about her posts on Yelp being reprehensible and deeply harmful to the community fabric, and so she's been put on leave.
She said some fantastic quotes. Why is this buying tickets at a theatre, we assume? So why is there no separate line for just tickets? So what they have is barely educated morons trying to manage snack orders for the obese and also try to add $7 plus $7 like a fool. I remain in line with all the other idiots. Sort of thing. So it's just the way that she's talking about other people is not very inclusive, shall we say. And there's a PDF document of all her Yelp posts that have been...
Yeah, I recommend going through the PDF document. It's
If you're interested.
Especially... I mean, this is the kind of stuff I would, you know, some people who I went to school with, you know, haven't grown up in a interesting area. Like, I'd imagine this is one of the reasons that I have no problem not being on Facebook, because this is the kind of stuff I'd see on Facebook all the time. That's whereas true. If you're a dean at a prestigious Ivy League university and you're putting this out for public display, you're doing it wrong.
Well, it's an interesting call on digital footprints, really, because this is what they're all about, is that you go and use your identity online to do different things. And if at some point... that identity comes out somewhere that you don't want it to, then you're screwed. And this is why you need to look after what you do online and need to be aware of who's tracking you and where your stuff is stored and who can access that information, etc., etc.
There's lots of the, if you go through the reviews, it's actually quite funny. Like, and lots of the stuff, she reports her own speech and the conversation she had with the owners of establishments who she wasn't very happy with. And lots of the time she says things like, I'm Asian, I know rice.
Superb. Social psychology right there. Okay, next up.
Right, so the BBC. So this is on Tech Dirt, and this needs to be qualified by the fact that it's only the most offensive or inappropriate content, but it's talking about the new BBC policy, and it's the first that Tech Dirt say they've seen in which an organization threatens that it may contact your boss or school if it finds something offensive or inappropriate.
What do you think about that? Just at a surface level, what do you think?
I think that's ridiculous. So the way that I talked about this in my newsletter at the weekend was when I was at university, I did some politics modules, and it turns out I was no good at politics, and... it was really boring. The seminars were really boring compared to like the philosophy seminars I had, because it was basically like the person running the seminar, their approach was, guess what's in my head. Yeah. So I didn't go to them, and they sent a letter to my, and I think phoned my parents as well, informing them that I wasn't coming to these seminars. And I thought, well, okay, I'm 18, 19 years old. What would you have done if I was a mature student? Would you have phoned my wife? Like what's going on there? Would you? Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of, it's not quite patriarchy, but it's that kind of very seeing society as being very hierarchical, which I find problematic. So this is like, oh, in a personal capacity, you've said something which is offensive or inappropriate, therefore I'm going to contact your employer. That's different from your employer finding out about it, I think. So the Yale thing, that's an entirely appropriate response, I think, for that particular scenario where she's in charge of... So she's got a responsibility for students at her college. She's in charge of diversity and inclusion, and she's got a PhD in social psychology. So them suspending her for those particular kind of comments is absolutely fine, and they came to light. It wasn't like Yelp contacted Yale. Whereas this is almost the organization that you're using, a taxpayer-funded organization, well, not taxpayer, but license fee payer-funded organization, almost snitching on you. Okay, they say it has to be really, really bad, but they're the ones who are deciding whether it's really, really bad. And they'll contact your employer, not by contacting you first necessarily, but by going straight to them. And that threatens your ability to pay your mortgage, obviously. So it seems a bit problematic.
No, it's not good. It's quite interesting. So Ewan McIntosh's brother was in charge of BBC Online, or at least he was. And I wonder if this has come from him. Normally, he makes very sensible decisions, as far as I can tell, with what is a superb online service. But this, as you say, this strikes me as, so if you're going to have a principle of free speech going on in our world, people should be able to say what it is. What we don't get are examples of the sort of behavior the BBC are talking about. So we don't really know what we're talking about in that way. So it says offensive, inappropriate, or objectionable content. Well, I could place plenty of objectionable content on the BBC and about their bias at certain times or about whatever it might be. And to think that they would contact my employer about that without talking to me first, like without saying, look, we find this to be inappropriate, remove it.
And what would they do in my situation? I haven't got an employer. Would they contact all my clients and say, hey, this guy, you know?
Well, this is the interesting thing, isn't it? It'd be much better just to kind of block them off the BBC, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's an individual thing. So, yeah, I think any time when it for me, it all feeds in. I wouldn't be able to coherently put this together, but it all seems to be in the same kind of area of let's send troops in to protect ourselves. Let's lock down the internet. Let's do this kind of stuff. Let's protect people by doing this thing. Whereas actually what we need is people being more responsible for their own actions rather than
I'd like to read more about what the BBC think about this. And it's one of those things where they're making a move without really explaining what it is they're doing it for. Kind of thing. An interesting idea is the ISP is contacting the ISP. Isn't it interesting? and imagine having your internet turned off because you wrote something in anger, for example, on the BBC website, and you thought it was all right, or you belittled someone.
But let's go back to what we've talked about with Audrey Waters. She hasn't got comments, and she's blocks annotation on her website. And you know, you can imagine, instead of it being a blanket thing, her deciding, okay, well, if I've got the technology to do this, I'm going to block Doug, because actually he's been a dick, and I'm just going to block him. In the same way you can block people on social networks. That feels proportionate, yeah?
Yes.
Because this is my site, and I can do what I want, as opposed to, oh, Doug's been a dick, and now I'm going to contact his boss.
Yeah, so like the Wikipedia, I mean, I don't know why that isn't used more, actually. You know how Wikipedia blocks your IP address for contributing and editing their pages if you did why isn't that technology used more, that approach? Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Well, I think that's because you have dynamic IPs often with ISPs.
Oh, I see. Well, I don't know. It'd be... Anyway, so there we go. That's what they're trying to do.
Yes. Anyway, anything else in here that you want to...
Yes. I'd like to talk about... Four-ways cognitive load theory has changed my teaching.
Okay. So this... So I really like aggregators. And there's a few aggregators that I frequent. And I've got those in my bookmarks bar in Chromium, like I mentioned before. One thing that I, just as an aside, one thing that, you know, bookmarks are an interesting, slightly anachronistic thing, aren't they? And I noticed that Nate Otto from formerly the Badge Alliance, now Concentric Sky, etc., when there was a screenshot of his screen that I saw relatively recently, and he just deleted all of the descriptive part of the bookmarks just to leave the fave icons at the top so you could see what they were, which allows you to put lots and lots of bookmarks in a short amount of space, which I have now copied.
That makes a lot of sense.
Mm. So there's a few that I now visit. One's called Skimfeed, skimfeed.com, which takes all popular headlines from tech places. There's Tech Meme, which has the most popular things, pop URLs, but also one called Spigot, which has been going for a few years now. It's an automated kind of thing based on RSS, and it's created by the DML people. Like, I write at DML Central. And at Spigot, this is where I came across this particular thing around cognitive load theory and how it's changed this guy's teaching. The guy's called Greg Ashman, and he goes through the different four reasons. Shall we go through them quickly?
Number one is I don't read out my slides. So he has a PowerPoint for every lesson, has access and lesson plan, starter activity, lists homework, states the learning intention, reminds me to take the register, displays notes, contains class examples and questions along with solutions on the subsequent slides. He prints the selections, a selection of the slides, to hand them to the students, and they glue the slides into their exercise books. Oh my gosh, really? And then they answer any questions in their book. But he does not go through it. And so the principles that are going on here, cognitive load theory is all about not loading learners up with too much information because they're not going to be able to process it, sort of thing. Yeah. So that's one of the ways that he has done that.
Yeah, and just to quickly, cognitive load theory is pretty much all you expect to be, just to read the Wikipedia definition. In cognitive psychology, cognitive load refers to the total amount of mental effort being used in the working memory. Cognitive load theory was developed out of the study of problem solving by John Sweller in the late 1980s. Sweller argued that instructional design can be used to reduce cognitive load in learners. Cognitive load theory differentiates cognitive load into three types: intrinsic, extraneous, and germane. So the second thing that Greg talks about in this post is break it down further. And he says that he talks about how new learning is quite transient. I guess that fits in with the solo taxonomy, that kind of stuff. And he says that information will quickly disappear from students' mind without the opportunity to process it. And I know that people like, he mentions at the top, doesn't he? He mentions Dylan William, Daniel Willingham, people like that. They talk about knowledge as a basis and a scaffold and a structure, and I think that's what he's trying to get at here, in terms of you create a new little bit of knowledge or a bit of understanding, you have to kind of reinforce it and situate it in an interesting way.
Yes. Number three is example problem pairs. I quite like this one. So this is about what we tend to do is we'll do some work with pupils in class and then send them home to do some homework with a slightly upgraded version of the problem or a twist on the problem. So it's not the same thing that they're doing, but they're actually developing it. And this is an interesting thing, I think, if I remember this correctly, I'm not reading it right now, is that you give them exactly the same problem, but with different, say, numbers in it or something like that, to do at home, because it's that repetition of the process in a different context that's actually valuable for their learning, rather than often giving them something that they will have to struggle with it doesn't secure the learning as well. Is that right?
Yes. So he's saying that you have a card with, on one side, you have the question that you want them to answer. And on the other side of the card, you have a worked example that shows them what to do. And as you say, let's say it's maths, then you literally just substitute some of the numbers. You don't try and go to transfer straight away. You don't try and extend their knowledge by asking slightly different questions. You literally do the same thing to like cement their learning before you move on. And he says that he's often moved on too early and because he wants to make them flexible, but I probably just cause frustration in students who were struggling.
And so big deal for me in programming this is. So quite often what we will do is set pretty, you know, the guides that I use, set up pretty noddy examples of where, you know, copy this test out, do this, and your program will do this, run it, see, does it? Yeah, does it, great. Right, now go on and take this challenge. And the challenge usually is not a repeat of that, that sort of code structure that they've just learned or just done. It's it adapts it in some way and takes a code from a couple of questions and mashes it together or whatever. And the pupils feel quite lost. And I think, so in my programming, so I teach a lot of programming for the first time, a lot of the time, I'm going to sort of take this idea and say, right, I want you to take that code and make this. And I mean, it's pretty much identical. But the point being is that for the learner, they feel like they're looking at something. They can't just copy it, but they can take it and just substitute in a different set of content or whatever, and do exactly the same.
Because you're learning the model, yeah. And it's a bit like when Kathy Sayre talks about deliberate practice, and you know, taking something that you can demonstrably get better at within 45 minutes to 45 to 60 minutes.
Number four is yours.
Yes, stop after 5 minutes. So he's talking about cognitive struggle and how, like, if you give them... So he says, like, a subtle example is students given a maths problem to solve with no immediate solution, they will kind of have this generic problem-solving strategy, and then, yeah. What he's basically saying is that if a student has to spend more than 5 minutes figuring out how to solve a homework problem, then the task that they've been set is wrong, because they can't really apply their knowledge. What they're doing is just really struggling and they don't know what's going on. And so what he's saying is that you should put a circle around that question, the one that you don't know, and raise it with me next time rather than struggling through it. And I feel like Khan Academy kind of does this in its interface by having a button that says, I haven't learned this yet. And then you can still move onto things that you know and you're practicing, whilst then flagging up something that you need to learn or reinforce rather than struggling.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing. So quite often I will vary the pace of my lessons. So sometimes I'll take a 45-minute block and think, right, I want to achieve something quite simple in this, but I want the children to really secure it, and be quite slow in my learning or their learning and my teaching. And other times I will just get them to push on at great speed. And it's just interesting to reflect upon. Right, it is 1 o'clock, Doug. I have to roll.
Okay, right. So just very quickly, what are you up to this week? You're on holiday, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm on holiday, so I haven't yet decided. I'm going to meet up with Elon Ezekiel next week and go for his house for supper. That should be really nice. And other than that, I have no plans.
Cool. Half term for me. I'm taking it easier. So thank you, everyone, for listening. And I hope if you're on holiday, you have a good holiday. If not, then just take it easy anyway. Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a darker bay, wasting time.